Hello and hello to a new episode of OMR Media. This is Pia Frey, host of this podcast in which we're interviewing the most interesting people from the media industry. I'm also co-founder of Opinory, the one and only Berlin-based and publisher-driven company that enables newsrooms and brands to engage, understand, and convert their users. I'm very excited about this episode today with John Saroff, who's the CEO of Chartbeat. Anyone who's ever worked in an online newsroom probably knows Chartbeat. They made themselves indispensable as the first company who enabled publishers to measure the performance of their content in real time, which hasn't been done before. I know that's hard to imagine. Now they grew into one of the biggest players on the field of content analytics for publishers. And I found it super interesting to speak with John about what metrics actually matter. Spoiler, it goes way beyond just clicks. And how newsrooms' interest in which data actually matter shifted over time when subscriptions and loyalty became a thing in the industry. We talked about how interest differs between markets, different types of publishers, and which newsrooms are making the best use of their real-time insights. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome, John, to OMR Media.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here. And there are many smart industry people listening to this podcast who know exactly what Chartbeat does. But there are also my parents listening to this podcast who often complain they don't understand what I'm talking about. So can you explain to anyone who's listening to this podcast who you, John, CEO of Chartbeat, are and what Chartbeat is doing?
Sure, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. Hallo, Germany.
Well pronounced.
Say it again.
Well pronounced. Hallo.
Hallo.
Your hallo.
Yes, it's an honor to be here. Even though we're in New York, it's a wonderful to kind of speak to our friends in Germany through Pia's world. So thank you for having me. I also probably this is the first podcast I think I've. Probably been on in a long time, so I probably will play my parents this podcast as well.
That's an honor.
So yes, so I will explain to them what I do, which is they don't really understand. So what is Chartbeat doing right now? So Chartbeat, for those of you who don't know us, is the leading kind of analytics tool for publishers. You know, we're a product and a company that is singularly devoted to a concept that we call making meaningful stories thrive. And what that is that we build...
Is that your claim?
Yeah, that's our vision. That's the stated vision of the company. So I wouldn't call it a claim. If it was a claim, I would say that we have already done it and we're just 5 or 10% of the way there. But it is our vision. And we believe that analytics and feedback tools and intelligence products can help those who create content understand what is resonating with their users in a very profound and meaningful way. So we build a suite of tools that is typically used by editors, journalists, and kind of audience development folks inside of major media companies around the world that helps them see how their stories are performing both in real time and on a kind of historical basis. And, you know, Chartbeat is a lot of things to a lot of people. It's a deep analytics tool that helps you understand, you know, how and why your stories are performing. It's a leaderboard.
How do you find performance? So what measurements are you measuring?
That's a very good question. You know, we measure everything most traditional analytics products measure, but we put the emphasis in different places. Because our vision is so around the notion of the story and letting the story thrive, another way that we put it that probably translates across borders better is that we want every story to live its best life. And we feel that the traditional metrics of page views and uniques and dwell time aren't really the thing that those who are creating stories need to understand. We believe that the most important metrics for media creators to understand our notion of concurrency, which is how many users are on a story at any given time. Most media stories are very, very short-lived. They last for 3, 4, or 5 hours. In order for that story to live its best life, you need people to be consuming it at the moment. We also focus on something called engaged time, which is the amount of time that users spend actually consuming the content. And we also focus on
how do you measure that versus just time on site?
So that's a something that we're very proud of, and I think something that we've moved a lot of our peers and a lot of news organizations towards, which is this notion that ordinary time on site is not a particularly effective metric. Ordinary time on site, you open the page, a clock starts, you leave the tab open, you close the tab, the clock stops. If you looked on my phone or my computer right now, you'd see I probably have 12 or 13 tabs open in my browser, both in mobile and on desktop. And we moved in 2009 timeframe, we invented a concept called engage time, which actually measures the amount of time the user is actively consuming the content on the page. And we measure that active consumption time, which we call engage time, by seeing whether there has been a cursor tap, a mouse movement, on mobile, a scroll, or a tap of any kind. And what that gives us is a sense that there's actually someone else on the screen. Mm-hmm. Right? I've had customers who have never seen Chartbeat, and their eyes light up because they've spent their entire lives as journalists or as editors writing and creating and publishing into the void. And then all of a sudden they turn on Chartbeat and they realize that there are really people out there. And I think,
Yeah, right. Journalists typically or often don't like numbers, right? And so, but you're serving numbers to the newsroom. How do you make them actionable?
It's a good question. Well, I think the first thing we do is we make them very friendly. I think, the Chartbeat is in some ways a very unique place because we have the two places where we spend the most money are engineering and design. And we do that very intentionally, right? We strive to make our numbers kind of come alive for people.
What does it mean if I was a publisher with main business goal to drive subscriptions?
Yep.
How do I use the numbers that I see on my Chartbeat dashboard mirroring my content?
It's a great question. I think, to a German audience, it's a different answer than to an American audience. In Germany, what we have seen is that most of the publishers who are subscription focused have a what we in the United States call a freemium focus, right? There's some content that anyone can consume and some content that only subscribers can consume. And what you typically see for our freemium customers is that actually segmenting the content by subscriber status is a very, very, subscribers are just different. They want something different. And it can be sometimes difficult to figure out what actually it is different that they want. And one of the things that Chartbeat is very able to do in a freemium world is help people understand, okay, once you've paid and you are, a member of, Bild or Welt or Frankfurt or Allgemeine or, Spiegel Online, once you've paid and you're a member, what are the content differences, right? What are the things, how are you behaving differently as a user? What content are you looking at differently? And in the freemium world, we see that a lot, right? In the freemium world, especially in continental Europe, what you tend to see is that, the hard news is the stuff that is free and maybe the lifestyle stuff or the, kind of emotional stuff or the celebrity stuff is behind the wall. And those, they can almost be like two different brands within a publisher. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that one of the things that we've seen with freemium customers is that they actually have to really, really be thinking on, how do I keep those brands distinct? So that customers understand, so that users understand and readers understand what the point of column A is and column B is, while at the same time unifying them behind a single brand. Because when we've seen freemium not work well, it's because the paid stuff has almost become like clickbait, right? That what you see a world where because users are paying essentially for a pass to special and unique content, that content can become very divorced from the rest of the site. Mm-hmm. In the United States, you see a lot more hard paywalls and what we call metered paywalls. Mm-hmm. And there, customers use Chartbeat much more to understand how the user is going through kind of almost like a marketing funnel, right? What's the difference between, you know, how many new users do I have who have never been to my site before? How many returning users do I have who have been but have not yet subscribed? Mm-hmm. And then how many subscribers do I have? And, you know, what they use Chartbeat to see is, you know, on any given day, you know, what are the different ratios and how is the content responding to mm-hmm. those ratios?
Okay. I think my parents understood the product.
Okay, good.
I hope.
I went way past your parents in my deep dive into freemium versus metered models.
But no, I think they get it. Okay. Just a few more notes on the company. So your business model works that in the way that publishers are paying you. How much?
You know, what is it? What is it to get in the door here? Our smallest contract is in the, you know, five figures US, very small. Mm-hmm. And our biggest contract is in the seven figures US. And mm-hmm. there's a broad range. And we charge based on traffic. So, mm-hmm. you know, the largest publishers in the world pay a disproportionate amount to the, you know, kind of local and regional players.
Mm-hmm. Are you still a startup?
It feels that way. I mean, it's a funny.
Many big companies want to be a startup.
Big companies want to be a startup, but I think that, what's his name? Who's the CEO of Axel Springer? Dr.
Döpfner.
Yeah. I think Dr. Döpfner and I go to sleep worried about very different things. There's a saying about CEOs that we sleep like babies. We wake up screaming every night at 2:30. And I think that me and Dr. Döpfner probably both wake up screaming at 2:30, but about very different things. So if he would like
it's
to
a
come
very disturbing
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, if he would like to come to New well, we know, it would not be in the same bed. We would be in different beds, yeah, to be okay. clear. But Matthias, if you're listening and you would like to, you know, run Chartbeat for 24 hours, I'll come run Axel Springer for 24 hours and you can tell me if we're more like a startup and if you'd rather be like us or be like you. You know, we're 10 years old. And
how much money did you raise in these 10 years?
$31 million. Uh-huh. And with that 10 years, you kind of lose your ability to say you're a startup, right? I mean, you know, companies have companies have been like the hottest thing and died, right? Probably during four Chartbeat life cycles. You know, but we still are a small, very, very, very nimble company. I mean, mm-hmm. we are only 70 people. You know, we are only in this one office here in New York. And I think one thing that makes us unique is that, you know, growth is important. And it's, you know, certainly the most important thing from a financial standpoint, which I think is common with startups. But we are much, much, much more vertically focused and much more clear on what our priorities and what our mission is mm-hmm. Than I think a lot of other quote unquote startups. Mm-hmm. You can't be, one of the things that we've learned over the years is you can't be all things to all people. And for us, being, you know, very, very focused on this market and this customer base and serving it is I think a little unique.
How much money do you make in a year?
Me personally?
No. As a company.
Oh.
You can even tell me about your own salary.
Me personally is not a lot. Let me think about how much money we make personally. I mean, how much money do we make in a year? I think I probably can't tell Germany that. I mean, you can.
They're not only German listeners. There are some.
Yeah, but I enjoy this. It's imaginary, you know, I'm imagining the, you know, the harbor of Hamburg and, you know, the Brandenburg Gate and, you know, the Frankfurt Börse, you know, all stopping to listen to me. It's a very nice image. You know, I probably can't, my PR team would probably kill me if I said how much we make. But, you know, we do okay, right? We make less than Uber, less than Facebook, less than Pinterest, but more than the coffee shop across the street.
Okay.
Is that a broad enough range for you?
Satisfying enough.
Yeah. I will say
more than 50 million.
No, we do not make more than 50
million. More than 10 million.
Yes, we do make more than 10 million. Actually, that's fair. I was at a software conference last week. Very good way to frame it, Pia. And maybe you cut some of this blathering that we're doing. But I was at a conference last week, a software conference, and I thought it was very interesting. It was for kind of software, you know, people. I spend much more time in media conferences than at software conferences, so I thought it'd be fun to go to a software conference. And they had pins that you could put on your shirt to show how where you were from revenue. And the pins were very interesting. There was a pin that said 0 to 1.5 million. Then there was a pin that said 1.5 million to 5 million. Then there was a pin that said 5 million to 10 million. Then there was a pin that said 10 million to 50 million. And then there was a pin that said 50 million plus. Right, so I got the 10 million to 50 million pin. Okay,
how did you feel about the pin? With the pin, about the pin,
I was very, very happy to have it. But I look forward to the day when we can wear the top pin. Move to the next pin. I also thought of myself, given that one of the things that we pride ourselves on at Chartbeat is being very honest. We, for example, as a software company, we rarely sell ahead of where we are. We're very straightforward with our customers about what we have and what we don't have and how we can deliver and et cetera. And sometimes it gets us into trouble, but we try to be very transparent. And I actually thought to myself, well, wait a second, you know, I would make sure that I was at $50 million and 1 cent before I put on that pin. But I'm sure, given that I'm at a software conference in San Jose, California, there are some guys who are at 30 million who are wearing the $50 million pin, and they're like, yeah, I'm at 50, right? But they're really at 30. You know who would never do that? Dr. Dupfner. Dr. Dupfner would never do that.
No, he wouldn't know.
He also has to publicly report his revenues to the Frankfurt Bourse, so, and to the New York Stock Exchange. So.
Right. What's the most important performance metric these days for your clients? From all these range of,
you know, it's a great question. It is rapidly changing. I think if you had asked me 5 years ago, I would have told you the page view, maybe the unique, but probably the page view, and I would have told you how we were crusading against it. Now, what I find is one of the best things about publishing is that in 2019, as opposed to 2014, is that people have realized that each business needs a unique, not necessarily unique to them, but a distinct metric that orients to what they're trying to do. So, for example, you know, the New York Times very famously has said, you know, through their 2020 report, that subscribers are the metric. And they have done a wonderful job of, you know, making sure that, you know, every department is kind of lined up against subscriptions, right? For some of the big cable news brands in the United States, some of the big television news brands, right? For their web presences, reach is the most important thing measured in uniques. Why? Because, you know, they see themselves as mass market brands that want to reach as many people as possible. So for them, you know, uniques are the most important. For a lot of our ad-supported publishers who rely, you know, that's very New York.
That's so New York.
It's very New York. That's NYPD blue, right?
We didn't order this.
Yeah, that's Law and Order, right? For very ad-driven publishers, especially those who are trying to sell to national and global audiences, for them, page views are still important because page views pay the bills. And I actually, you know, the thing that I hated about 5 years ago was when everyone, regardless of their business model, was just obsessed with page views, right? You know, and now what you're seeing is there's just a little bit more sophistication. In addition to more sophistication, there's more alignment, right? The thing that I think really, really hurts publishers is when the editorial team, the marketing team, the product team, and the finance team all care about different things. And one of the things that you're seeing as people, you know, begin to understand their businesses better is you're just beginning to see better alignment across those departments. But you obviously wouldn't want to be an ad-supported publisher and care about subscriptions, or a because they don't matter to you, right?
And for subscription-focused publishers, which article metric matters most to them? Time on site? Dwell time?
So, TBD. The thing that we're seeing is that there's some combination of how often a user visits, how frequently they visit, and how much they consume that is becoming increasingly important. And I think everyone is trying to figure out, of those three, what are the respective weights, et cetera. You know, when we have done some early studies into subscription research, what we've seen is that there's this combination of, how often, how much, and how recently. And I think you're going to see some action in that area. I think one thing that we have seen is that kind of last click attribution, where you attribute the subscriber to the article they're on when they subscribe, is actually not particularly effective. There's a sense that, like, oh, if we just knew that, you know, articles by Bob Smith drove subscriptions, we would hire Bob Smith and pay him more money. And that's not really the way people think. People think about subscribing to a publisher as a buying a bundle of goods that includes all of the content, maybe some sort of brand association with that content. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're trying to do is work with our clients to come up with the metrics and tools to figure out how to drive that.
Mm-hmm. And do you see differences between general news publishers, niche publishers, or industry sides, local publishers, in what numbers they care about most?
Yeah, I think that the broad reach folks are, I think, actually, they have the most difficult job. I actually think that they are most of the broad reach folks, whether it's national or international, they have a privilege because it is their historical strength and their brand that have given them broad reach, right? But I actually think their jobs are hard because their legacy business models, whether they're web advertising or something else, actually still generate tremendous amounts of revenue. And it's very hard to wake up tomorrow morning and say, I'm going to go to a hard paywall if your ad sales team is still bringing in hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And whereas if you're niche or local, mm-hmm. it can be much, much easier to just say, okay, we're going hard paywall.
And one way, Benny, general news publishers try to deal with it is identifying the niche audiences within their broad content portfolio where they have such a credibility for a niche audience that increases their willingness to pay, right?
So give me an example.
For Die Bild, for example, mm-hmm. Identify that my coverage on wrestling has a very loyal and very sticky audience. So I can put all my wrestling content behind a paywall if I'm freemium and build a bucket of my audience that is making revenues
mm-hmm.
and is more valuable than with my ads.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that
stream of revenues. So do your metrics help publishers to identify specialty and niche audiences that are potential direct revenue streams?
So from a content perspective, yes. From a user perspective, no. And I mm-hmm. think it's important to separate that. We made a decision in our infancy to not track any personal identifiable information, mm-hmm. which came in extraordinarily handy last summer when we were preparing for GDPR. Mm-hmm. So we don't collect any PII, including any user identifiable information. So I can't tell any of our clients in Europe especially, but anywhere, what the user behavior is. So, you know, Bob comes 10 times to wrestling content, but comes 0 times to, you know, the front page. What I can tell them is, in aggregate, the users who view wrestling content tend to be a lot more loyal than the users who view football content.
Yeah.
And what you see is that the niches, you know, are just extraordinarily powerful. I mean, like, there are some, you know, you see this also with language, right? Like our, and you and I were talking about this in the pre-call, right? But our sites that have the most loyal users are sites where there are very, very, niche, but niche literate communities, mm-hmm. right? So we have some clients in the Baltics, for example, in Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, and they have like just incredibly loyal readers, right?
Interesting.
And you know, why do they have incredibly loyal readers? They're very literate populations that care deeply about news and information. Mm-hmm. And there tend to be, you know, it's a small market, so there tend to only be like one or two players or in those markets, and those things are just super loyal. And I think there's an analogy to, you know, I don't know how big wrestling is in Germany, right? But there's an analogy to your wrestling example, which is, you know, there's probably a group.
It's not so big.
It's not so big. There's probably a group
but
of.
But it's big for Bild.
It is big for Bild, right? Yeah. So there's probably a group of wrestlers and their families who just want to read about wrestling, and they know that if they're going to go somewhere, they're going to go to Bild.
Yeah.
And you see that, you know, I actually think that paradoxically, the in countries like the United States, it's actually harder because once a market is big enough, there's so much competition because the mm-hmm. there just becomes the ability to enter much more easily. And I think the thing that has really created all of this disruption in media is, you know, the fact that if you and I wanted to do this 40 years ago, right, we would need not only a much bigger recorder than the one that's sitting on the desk here, but we would need a formal studio, an antenna, you know, we'd have to pay somebody to you know, work on the distribution relationships to get it to the United States and get it to Germany. Right now, you know, we're doing this on, you know, this device that's sitting in front of me, you know, and in, you know, a few days, this will be broadcast to anyone in the world who wants to see it. And, you know, we're the problem, right? We're the disruption. And I think, you know,
you mean that there's just so much more content.
And that it's so much more easy to create, right? It's much easier to create, and it's much easier to distribute. The cost of creating content has essentially dropped to zero, and the cost of distributing content has essentially dropped to zero.
And back to these national differences, what are the specialties that you see with Germans?
You know, I actually think German media is there are a few countries in the world that have big enough markets to sustain healthy media, have literate enough populations where people consume that media, but aren't so big that attract incredible amounts of competition, right? You know, so... And I think Germany is one of those markets.
From that sense, life is easier for a German publisher than for an English-speaking publisher.
I wouldn't say easier.
Competition is smaller.
Your
audience is big enough.
Yeah, your addressable market is certainly smaller, right? I imagine part of the reason why Axel Springer bought Business Insider and eMarketer is because they wanted to be able to access bigger markets, right? At some scale, you have to start accessing other mm-hmm. language markets, right? But you can still build a reasonably good and a reasonably good size and a very profitable media company inside of Germany, selling and marketing to Germans. I think in smaller markets, like, you know, take my Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania mm-hmm. example, right? There's only one or two players in each of those countries, mm-hmm. right? You take my US example, the addressable market is much, much bigger, mm-hmm. but the competition is just insane.
What right? specialties do you see with the German audiences? Do they behave differently? Like an Estonian audience is super loyal.
I mean, they're more loyal than American audiences. I mean, I'd actually have to, you know, be happy to follow up with you on this. We'd have to pull the data, right? But, you know, when you look at American audiences tend to, we have a metric in our tool called recirculation, mm-hmm. and it's the percentage of people that have viewed essentially two pages on a publisher. Mm-hmm. So in the United States, you're doing pretty well if you're at 8 to 12%. Mm-hmm. If you go to a country like, let's say, Japan, right, you open up the Chartbeat dashboard and you think there's a bug because everybody's at 35 to 40%. And that's a combination of literacy, the size of the market, the language. And actually, I'm embarrassed to say I should have pulled it before, but I don't actually know what the German number is. But I would imagine that it's bigger than the United States and smaller than Japan.
It mirrors our experience that we see engagement rates, meaning people who are addressed with the question, engaged with our tools, are much higher in Germany and in UK than in the US. Not much higher, but at least 25% higher in Europe.
The UK example surprises me.
Yeah?
Because the UK...
I think they're just so opinionated by Brexit.
Well, that's right. I mean, Pia is referencing the product that she loves and spends a lot of time on called OpenAIRY, which is an opinion polling tool. So, exactly. Right, it may be skewed. The Brits may just want to tell. They're frustrated with their own parliament, so they want to tell somebody what they're thinking. But the UK market is really interesting because I think actually. I love the UK market. I think it's fascinating. And I think it's fascinating for all sorts of reasons that Americans could learn a lot from. I think that strong UK publishers have an incredible opportunity to thoughtfully penetrate the American market. I think one example that I give to a lot of my British clients is soccer coverage, right? Football and soccer coverage in the United States just, is good, but it's niche, right? You have to really, mm-hmm. really know where to look. And, there are probably more Premier League fans. I mean, I'd have to do the math, but there may be more Premier League fans in the United States than there are in the UK. Just because, if one out of every 10 Americans is a fan, mm-hmm. right? It's probably not there.
It's
probably not there yet. Yeah. But I bet in 20, 25 years, mm-hmm. there will be more Premier League fans in the United States than there are in the UK. The Premier League here has just grown by leaps and bounds. And I think there's an incredible opportunity for the Times, the Telegraph, the Mirror, the Express, even the locals, the Liverpool Echo, the Manchester Evening News, Cornwall Guardian, right? Mm-hmm. I bet this is the first time the Cornwall Guardian's ever been mentioned on your podcast. I think there's a tremendous opportunity for them to target American audiences uh-huh. because they don't have to buy Business Insider to get access to the market.
Right.
All they have to do is, buy some search ads or, put the stuff on Facebook or whatever. I'm a big Liverpool fan and I, get my news from the Liverpool Echo and mm-hmm. 25 years ago, first of all, I wouldn't have been a Liverpool fan because there wouldn't have been soccer on in the United States at all. And I wouldn't have known what the Liverpool Echo was. And now, I know exactly who James Pearce is and, he's the guy in the boot room and, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. From your helicopter understanding that you have on the industry around the world, what would you see as the most innovative market? Most forward-thinking in media innovation?
It's a very good question, actually. It's a very, very, very good question. I hate to say it because it sounds like such a terrible answer, but I think the United States. I think, and I really hate to say it. I mean, those of you who don't know me, right, I'm pretty American, right? A lot of my friends from overseas say that I'm the stereotypical American, right?
Really?
I like hot dogs and apple pie and whatever. I am married to a French woman. My children all speak French, so that biases me a little bit. But I think the American venture capital market just creates a dynamism mm-hmm. in media. That is, there's going to be failures, right? Not all of, Vice, BuzzFeed, Vox, you know, already Mike, you know, closed down, right? But there's a dynamism and an experimentation there that, you know, when we walk around Europe, we just don't see, right? You see European dynamism in certain places, like there's a European, I think they're called like the European Journalism Accelerator or something like that in London. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see a dynamism where, you know, they're funding kind of small community things, right? The Google News Initiative is much bigger in Europe than it is in the United States, right? They funded a lot of really interesting kind of, you know, small European media businesses.
Yep.
You know, but if you, you know, what Jonah Peretti and the gang at Vox and Shane Smith have been able to do at Vice, regardless of whether or not they, in the long run, provide a return to their shareholders, Arianna Huffington at HuffPo and Ken Lehrer at HuffPo, regardless of what the ultimate returns are to their shareholders, they've taught us all a tremendous amount. And they've moved the entire industry forward, right? I mean, Chartbeat wouldn't exist but for that world either, right? I mean, you know, we, in our roots, are all in the learnings that those first venture-backed publishers gave the world. And a lot of what we are is, you know, kind of the translator of, you know, taking the skills that a lot of those folks learned in the early days and bringing them to newsrooms around the globe. And we don't, none of them ever invested in us, none of them.
Right? Wait, in what sense? What learnings from these digital-only new players?
Yeah, I mean,
been taking to, you know, legacy publishers. Yeah,
HuffPost was really, I mean, real early HuffPost, right? I don't even know what year it was, but they were the first place to have, you know, a scoreboard, right? Mm-hmm. Gizmodo, sorry, you know, I'm trained. Gawker, they used to be called Gawker, right? The old Gawker was the, you know, Nick Denton was one of the first people to say, you know what, like, I'm going to make sure that all of my journalists know how readers are receiving their content, and I'm going to make sure that, you know, readers are, you know, engaged in the commentary process. Mm-hmm. And I just think a lot of what Chartbeat has done has been, you know, in the early years, our vision was, and our vision has always been the same, but in the early years, our kind of sales, you know, was, mm-hmm, get the data to the front lines, mm-hmm, right? And over time, you know, the first thing we did was get the data to the front lines. The second thing we did was change the focus from being around page views and uniques to being around engagement, right? Mm-hmm. You know, now we're leading a focus around optimization, and both from with kind of the stuff we do with headline testing and with our subscription products. But that first instinct, which even predates me, right? I joined 4 years in and you know, we were already kind of past it. But that early instinct, Tony Hale, my predecessor, you know, used to say that, you know, that, and I actually don't know if this is true or apocryphal, that we were referred to as an arms dealer, right? And that we took the early stuff that HuffPost invented and we just spread it around the world. Mm-hmm. And then once we spread it, we realized that it wasn't enough to have a leaderboard. If you had that kind of power, you had to use it wisely to help people build their businesses. Mm-hmm. And I think since 2011 and 2012, we've really, really focused on that, right? Once we've realized the privileged position that we occupy in the world's newsrooms, you know, we've made sure to use that power very, very wisely and to make sure that, you know, impactful content is making its way on people's screens.
Mm-hmm. Back to the country differences in Germany. Ben Smith said on this podcast that he thinks Germany is in some ways quite weird resistant against innovation and new things, which is, for example, mirrored by the fact that no digital-only new publisher player is in the top 15 in the German hit list. Do you see an aversion against innovation in Germany?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I have not I went to DLD a couple of years ago, and there was a tremendous amount of introspection by German panelists mm-hmm. on this issue. And
we need to digitalize.
No, not even we need to digitalize, but, you know, how come, why is Berlin Berlin and not San Francisco?
Okay.
You know what? I'd rather live in Berlin than San Francisco. I mean, I really would. And, you know, the food's better. The beer's better.
It's cheaper.
Is it cheaper? I don't know. I mean, I guess it is. I mean,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, I 20 years ago, I don't know if it was, right? But now it is, right? I mean, San Francisco isn't San Francisco anymore, but that's it for another podcast. But, you know, Berlin. Why do you don't need a digital only publisher when you have the consumer dictates, right?
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that if there were customers in Germany that were thirsting for information that they just couldn't get, right? You would have started that, right? You're an enterprising, you know, German, you would have started that. Instead, you started a polling thing, right? And, you know,
driving loyalty, engagement, and
exactly, right? You can call my thing an analytics thing. I don't care, even though I'm driving loyalty and engagement. And I think in the United States, the venture model upends that, because what the venture model does is, you know, if you had started. You know, if you had found a niche in, you know, let's pick on wrestling again, and you said, okay, I'm going to be Pia the wrestling publisher, right? You would have had to essentially bootstrap it and do it from scratch. In the United States,
you would have gotten funding.
Right, Ariana and Jonah and Trey Brundred, who, you know, started Vox with, you know, in the early days when it was just SB Nation, you know, they went to Sand Hill Road, they showed a deck. And they emerged with funds that just gave them the scale to take on the world. So I don't know if Ben is right or wrong. I don't know the context, and I think he spent more time in Germany than I have. But I also think that your media market does a relatively good job serving
the needs of basic needs.
Yeah, not basic. I mean, pretty. Yeah. I mean, you also have a much more vibrant. Public sector media too, right? Yeah. We have no public sector media, none. Yeah. I mean, we have PBS and NPR, but they're not even, they're much more distributor than they are creator, right? In addition to them, they're much more distributor than they are creator. And from a funding perspective on a per capita basis, I mean,
it definitely adds a lot of stability to the market.
And also I'll tell you one thing that I learned about your media.
Are you working with these public broadcast?
It is. I actually don't know if I'm allowed to. Our clients, we take the data of our clients and their confidentiality very closely, but we know both PBS and NPR very, very well.
And in Germany? ARD, ZDF?
So it's interesting, actually.
BL.
We work with, I don't know if we work with all of the. Uh-huh. You know, we definitely work with.
Then I'm basically funding you with my.
Yes, exactly. No, we definitely work with. We signed Südwestrundfunk first.
Yeah.
And I went up in front of the company. I was like, I want Nordwestrundfunk and Estrundfunk. and actually, one of the things I met a lot of those folks at a conference once. And one of the things that I thought was really, really amazing, and you're going to have to explain this to me, is, you know, in the United States, the regional players are not allowed to compete nationally, right? But Südwestrundfunk, which I think is by my German, the Southwest, right?
Yeah.
If you're in the Northeast, you can listen to them, right?
Sure.
Right. You say, sure. In the United States, that's crazy. Right,
but you can, for example, on NPR, you can listen to all these local stations.
In 2019, yes, but in 1999, no. Right,
I don't know about 1999.
No, but in Südwestrundfunk, as I understand it, right, all of the public German broadcasters were, even though they were localized, you could watch them nationally. You know, even 20 years ago, right? In New York,
No, wait.
We're gonna have to find out.
I have to find out.
But in New York, in the United States, all of that, all of that public media, and a lot of what we now think of as national media, was really an interesting hybrid of local and national, and that created incredible competitive advantage for those. No, the opposite of competition, competitive advantage,
right?
Because there was one. You know, there were four stations in New York. There was one PBS, one CBS, one NBC, one ABC, et cetera.
Let's zoom back into 2019.
Sure. It was so, everything was so much easier in 1999, though.
That's nostalgic. I think it's.
I know you guys hate. You guys hate. What is that?
Nostalgia.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgie.
Yeah, what's that? That's nostalgia for the East.
It's
right?
Like being nostalgic.
What's that great movie? That great German movie that I love?
Goodbye Lenin.
I love that movie.
Yeah, or Das Leben der Anderen.
What's that movie?
That's amazing. It's
what's
called Das Leben der Anderen, The Life of Others.
I've seen that. That movie's amazing too.
Yeah.
But Goodbye Lenin is the funny one.
Yes,
that movie's
funny.
Very
and
good.
Sonnenallee is super funny.
What is?
Sonnenallee.
I don't know that movie.
Super funny.
Okay, I'll watch that.
Leander Hausmann.
Yeah.
No nostalgia, no nostalgia. Right now, right here, what are the top traffic referrals and how have they changed over time?
That's like the standard chirpy question. So just to give context, I mean, you know, one of the great things about sitting in the chair that we do is that we get to see the effect that the platforms, Facebook, Apple, Google, Microsoft, have on our customers. Facebook has really, really, really declined in importance to our customers. They made an algorithm change in October of 2017 that was announced in January of 2018. And, you know, they went from being about 40% of external traffic to about 20% of external traffic in about 6 months. They've since, like, actually peaked back up, and we're trying to figure out why. But I think between the algorithm change and just the, you know, kind of assault that they've taken in the press on things like privacy, right? My customers are just talking a lot less about Facebook than they were a year ago or 18 months ago. Yeah. Google, on the other hand, is by far the number one referrer of traffic to publishers. They've done a couple of things. The AMP project, which is the Accelerated Mobile Pages project, which they are kind of the leader of, has just driven mobile consumption from search to highs never seen before. Google continues to grow in relevance. And I actually, you know, encourage my customers, you know, for a long time in the United States, SEO was, you know, viewed as kind of like a 2004 thing. And now, you know, I'm really encouraging my customers to invest in SEO.
What are the hidden champions?
The hidden champions?
Yeah.
You know, I actually think
the newcomers.
Yeah, I actually think one hidden champion, which you're going to laugh at me because it's as we speak, it may be the most valuable company in the world, is Microsoft. You know, MSN, which has been rebranded as Microsoft News, it doesn't deliver traffic, but it delivers exposure and revenue for customers, you know, Microsoft is actually making a big, big push to be thought of more in, you know, as not just kind of, you know, MSN. And then on kind of the emerging folks, there's a Chinese, I think it's Chinese, actually, you should look it up, called ByteDance.
I know. Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say?
I thought you meant this Japanese thing, NewsPick.
NewsPick. Yeah. NewsPick is pretty big in Japan, not huge in the United States yet. I think it's called ByteDance.
Uh-huh.
ByteDance is the company that owns both Taobao and TikTok.
Uh-huh.
And they have all of a sudden started becoming a much more meaningful referrer in the United States.
Interesting.
And I actually think that I know Taobao and TikTok, but I never thought of the company that owns them is called ByteDance. And we're actually, I think, probably going to be doing some more research into them because they're really beginning to show up for a lot of our customers.
Mm-hmm. Do you know this Upday in Europe?
Yes. So Upday is the joint venture of Axel and Samsung, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So Upday, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that we've seen on mobile is that what I call kind of the default installs on mobile. So on iOS, that's Apple News. Android, that can be Upday. In the United States, actually, Flipboard has a relationship with
Samsung.
So those folks just have tremendous power because nobody changes the defaults, right? Yeah. And the power of the default is real. I think the challenge that that a lot of those new players are going to have is that if those are really, really valuable relationships, the big tech players will get them, right? So you know, at some point, those things become... I mean, Google pays Apple... I don't know what the number is, but I think it's like something like $9 billion a year to be the default search engine on iPhones, right? If that real estate is really valuable, Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, and others are going to pay for that real estate. So,
last question, and after that, some rapid fire questions.
Okay.
You mentioned that Chartbeat right now is at 5 or 10%. There. So what are the remaining 90% for Chartbeat to come?
Great question. You know, I think when we say that we want to make meaningful stories thrive, we're a long way from that, right? I mean, you know, it captures what our product does in the moment for, you know, tens of thousands of journalists globally, right? It helps them understand if their stories are performing, and it helps them make them perform even better, right? Again, the other phrase that we frequently use is to have every story live its best life. But if you actually want to make meaningful stories thrive, you've got to get both into the monetization and you've got to get into the why, right? And I think those are the two big places where I want to push us, right? From a monetization standpoint, I don't want us to be, you know, a monetization player, but I do think that we can help customers understand, help our customers understand why their customers are choosing or not choosing to either dive deeper for an ad subscriptions, for an ad site, or to purchase for a subscription site. And I think for us, that's, we're spending probably about 15% of our engineering resources on solving that problem right now.
Do you think people will still continue to consume content through publishers or growing beyond that?
I think there's going to be a chip in everyone's head.
A
microchip implanted in everyone's head.
Yeah, yeah.
And Chartbeat will be measuring. No. no. So
yeah, why not? Go for it.
I don't know.
No, please don't.
There's a story that is on a lot of my... I start all of my decks with the same point, which is that, you know, 50 years ago, my dad grew up in New York City, and... he was a Brooklyn Dodger fan, and he would go down to the newsstand and he would buy a paper that no longer exists called the New York Herald Tribune. And he would, read a journalist that no longer exists, same, cause he's dead, named Red Smith. And he would read about a man that no longer exists called Jackie Robinson, and supporting a team that no longer exists called the Brooklyn Dodgers. 50 years later, my son is 12 years old. He likes baseball, but he really, really likes soccer because of his mother. He's a Paris Saint-Germain fan. So he goes on and reads L'Équipe and reads, you know, whatever the L'Équipe journalist is who's...
but basically doing the same.
The exact same thing, right? And, you know...
I started to listen much more than I read. Are you going to measure audio?
Listening takes much too much time. Reading is just a much more efficient way to consume and learn. I like listening.
But you can do things while listening.
Yeah, but you're not exactly. That's why it's better. I mean, and I actually get to, you know, the only time I really listen is when I'm in the car, because it's the thing I can focus on. Right? Like,
I think it depends on how much your brain can focus on.
I think I'm a big believer that humans can focus only on.
So
one
no
thing.
Audio for Chartbeat.
No, actually, just because I'm the way I am doesn't mean that Chartbeat. I mean, audio, over-the-top video, we measure web video now. We don't measure over-the-top video. Those are certainly interesting concepts. I think the challenge for those is they're super fragmented. I mean, one of the advantages that we have as a business is that, you know, a web page is a web page, and an app is basically an app, right? So for our customers, we can serve their two biggest modes of consumption just like that. Measuring podcasts and over-the-top video is, until those industries consolidate a bit, is just a bear. And it's also a bear for the amount of users that are there, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there are a lot of users listening to podcasts, I hope, or else I wouldn't be on this. There are a lot of users watching Netflix and Hulu, certainly. But the complexity for the return is very, very hard. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you focus on the web and apps, you can just help people understand a lot more mm-hmm. of their audience.
Okay, so what's the next big thing on your agenda, thriving towards the 90%?
Oh, so so you didn't let me finish. You interrupted me.
Sorry.
So I think
coming back to it,
I think the big technical push we're making this year is into subscriptions. I mean, I just think uh-huh. that, you know, whether or not I don't know if paid media will be the media market globally is $2 trillion. I don't know in 10 years if paid subscriptions will be 1% of that market, 2% of that market, 10% of that market, or 20% of that market. But I know it'll be something. And I want to make sure that we're helping our clients understand questions from, like, should we actually go to a paid model? Should we leave our ad model? You know, what's the right paid model for us? You know, how do I actually measure the effectiveness? How am I actually driving conversions? Those are the kinds of things that I...
Still on an aggregated level or even on a per-user level? Do you ever look at user data?
So I want to start on a aggregated level. Mm-hmm. Start with, I mean, you know, to get into the theory, there's two things that make you subscribe: your behavior and who you are, right? Or the two things that we can conceivably measure. I think there's a lot of energy going into the who you are, right? Like, is an 18 to 24 more likely to subscribe than a 24 to 34? I think there's not enough energy going into the, like, actually, what are the behaviors?
Yeah.
What's the what's the optimal bundle? Those are the kind of questions that I want to solve. Mm-hmm.
Okay, couple of rapid fire questions.
Okay.
You only answer with one sentence or less.
Okay.
Or A or B.
Okay.
Your favorite Chartbeat market outside of the US?
Probably the UK.
Okay.
The UK. It would be too... I would say Germany, but it's probably the UK. The UK media market. We should do an entire follow-up on just the UK media market. It is...
Oh, yeah. I have...
Fascinating.
It's fascinating. I have many questions on the UK as well. Okay, there are always different people you're probably working with at publishers,
yeah.
audience development, editorial, product, etc. Your favorite role at publishers, whom do you like to work best? Whom do you work with? Whom do you like working with best?
I like journalists. Uh-huh. Journalists and, you know, the line between journalist and editor is blurring a lot.
Yeah.
But I view, you know, I met my wife by writing an article in Cosmopolitan magazine. And being a journalist is an incredibly vulnerable position, in the sense that you put a little bit of yourself into the thing that you write, mm-hmm. and you don't really know if anybody's going to read it. And you deeply want people to read it, right? No one became a journalist to become a billionaire. They became a journalist because they want to be read. They've got a point of view. They got something to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I really lock brains with a journalist about what their lives are like and what they want to do. That's the most fun for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would you have become if not Chartbeat CEO?
Left back for Liverpool. Mm-hmm. I was a terrible soccer player. That's what I would have wanted to become: left back for Liverpool, shortstop for the New York Yankees. You know, to be honest, the two things that I loved as a kid and the two things that are media, like, I was just a rabid consumer of media as a kid. And And when media sounds too fancy, like, I just love reading magazines. I love reading about sports. I love reading about news. I love reading about everything. And I love numbers. And I think I probably would have figured out. And that's why I feel so fortunate to be in my job, because I'm in, that's what I do every day, right? So I probably would have figured out something to do. I actually would, you know, would have probably worked in a media company somewhere.
You know what's interesting?
What?
Most Germans stick to this one sentence rule, and most Americans don't.
Why should we?
That's so bold. Yeah. What publications, are you subscribed to?
I don't think you got time.
So many?
Oh my God!
But not with the Chartbeat account, but with your personal.
No,
account.
I pay for. We have a rule that every employee at Chartbeat gets $30 a month to pay for any content they want. I respect the rule, so I pay. I don't even think I really expense $30 a month. But just looking at my phone, the things that I pay for, ESPN Plus. Let's see. Now let's go to that's just the sports section. I pay for the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Washington Post, the FT. New York Magazine, The Athletic, The Wall Street Journal. I have a print subscription to Sports Illustrated, The Harvard Business Review, Consumer Reports. I have newsletter subscriptions to Ben Thompson, Stratechery, a guy named Joe Sheehan, who is like one of the best baseball bloggers, a guy named Joe Poznanski, who's one of the best baseball bloggers.
You're a real supporter of the industry.
No, I'm not a supporter of the industry. I pay for Spotify, I pay for Netflix, I pay for Hulu, I pay for Amazon Prime. I mean, I don't do it for charity. Like, this is what I like to do with my free time. Like, you spend your time listening to podcasts. I spend my time rabidly consuming these things.
Who has the best subscription product in a way that where you're treated best as a user?
That's a really, really good question. The best subscription product where I am treated best as a user. You know, I actually think probably maybe the Washington Post. I think the Washington Post you know, has a really, and we actually haven't mentioned them much in this one, so it's also a chance for me to kind of, you know, give them a shout out. You know, I actually think that a lot of publishers struggle with customer service, which is a huge part of this whole thing, right? And the Post, maybe because, you know, Bezos is consumer express, but probably just because they have a lot of smart people. Not only is the content as dynamic and as interesting, I mean, you know, the stuff that David Fahrenthold did on Trump was just amazing. But like, if you got a problem, they'll help you solve it. You try to email some of these other folks on like customer service problems, you never hear back.
Your favorite conference? Industry conference. Not the one where you pick your pin.
No, yeah, not that one. I'll give a shout out to the Online News Association conference, which is this year in New Orleans in 2000, and usually in September.
It's huge.
It's great.
Okay, that question is a little bit mean. Parsley dashboard or Taboola dashboard? What's better? Analytics dashboard.
I got to give a, I mean, listen, they are a noble competitor, but I got to give, the Parsley dashboard is much better than the Taboola dashboard, not even close.
And then Taboola or Outbrain?
The narcissism of small differences.
Okay. And I had a last, very last question, which was, what publisher would you work at?
If I could work at any publisher, I would find a publisher with a... Actually, you know what I would love to do? I would really, really, really love to do this after Chartbeat. I would love to... I grew up in New Jersey, or I could see myself doing this in the suburbs of New York. I would love to go to Gannett or McClatchy or Tribune, and I would love to buy, you know, and if you're listening, you can sell
the
them
mini Jeff Bezos.
No, no, no. I would buy five or six local papers serving a distinct geography in the United States, and I would really, really try to run them. So I like, you know, there's a publisher in Maine right now called Maine Today, and they're an agglomeration of like five Maine local papers that used to be kind of semi-competitive with each other, and now they're running as one company that's being very cooperative. And I actually think that they're onto something, and I think that the same thing could be done throughout the United States.
There are a couple of German sites from DuMont that are now for sale.
My German is bad. I mean, also maybe I should just, you know, given I will soon be a French citizen, you know, maybe I should do that in Lyon. The food is better. So,
you know. Okay. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
That was it. I recently heard from podcast people that you're not supposed to thank your listeners for listening. So no thank you. But I hope you've been able to get some insights and takeaways. If you have questions to John, you find him on LinkedIn or Twitter. If you have questions to me, reach me at peer@opinory.com or on any channel. And please leave a review on this podcast wherever you're listening. They are very, very helpful in every way. Tschüss. That was German. And bye-bye.